The last word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
It's time for the Culture Club, and I'm delighted that a very old friend of The Last Word is here to do the Culture Club. One of our leading novelists, the prolific John Connolly, is back here. He has a new novel, The Dirty South, the 18th Charlie Parker mystery. How do you keep doing coming up with storylines?
Well, you know, two kids, a mortgage, two dogs, all these things concentrate the mind wonderfully, Matt. Nice to see you in person. The last time we were talking was remotely.
So it was indeed.
Some semblance of normality.
Tell us a little bit about, though, because this Charlie Parker novel, you've gone back, haven't you, almost as a prequel to the very first breakthrough novel, Every Dead Thing.
Yeah, sometimes it's nice to write without the weight of 17 or 18 books of history hanging on your shoulders. You end up feeling a bit like Jacob Marley, dragging his chains around with him everywhere. And so it was liberating. And also it's quite nice to give new readers a chance to join a series, because sometimes if something has been going on for quite as long as the Parker books have, it's a bit like joining a party halfway through and a conversation where everybody's halfway through a joke that you haven't heard the beginning of. So it's a chance for new readers to join in as well.
But yet you have to be consistent in that prequel with everything that has followed over the 18 novels.
I did.
You?
So I got somebody else to read Every Dead Thing. I couldn't go back. And it's not like I think, oh, children, daddy's going to read something from his first novel this evening to entertain you over dinner. The idea of picking up my first book and having to read it myself, not much of an advert for it, it must be said, it would have just been too difficult. I mean, I wrote that when I was in my mid-20s, and it would be very difficult as a man in his early 50s now to go back and look at that again.
Would you be fearful that you would be very critical of it?
I think so. I hope I've improved as a writer. I mean, God, it would be depressing to think that after all this time people went, well, you know, the first one was very good, and then it was downhill all the way for the next 20 years. So it's very hard, I think, for any writer to look back at work that was done that long ago, because your instinct is always to want to change it. You think, if I went back into it now, I could improve it. And that way lies madness. You have to kind of live with your mistakes and learn from them and hopefully apply what you've learned to the books that follow.
You are prolific, though, because you've written literary fiction, which you've been here talking to us about before. You've written fantasy, you've written teenage books, you've written children's books. Do you ever stop writing?
No, my other half made me take today off, actually. She thought I was going to have a heart attack if I didn't stop. There is an element of compulsion to it. I think for most people who do something creative for a living, you have to be so self-motivated, because there isn't anybody standing over you to tell you to go up and work. There isn't a boss. You're always self-employed to a degree. And so you become very focused on what you do. And a little bit of, certainly in my case, obsessiveness creeps into it. If I don't work for a day, I get quite antsy. I feel I have to earn my time off.
But you're also big into the research. And I know that, you know, you have a house in Maine, you spend time in Arkansas and other places. Have you missed that because of lockdown?
Yeah, it's very difficult. The books I'm writing at the moment, I'm relying on kind of memory to do them a little bit. I love research. I find it fascinating to go to a new place, and I like talking to people. Part of the pleasure of it is, particularly for something like The Dirty South, which is essentially a historical novel, I needed to find people who had grown up in Arkansas during the period in which the book is set. I needed to find people who had been part of the police department, who had dealt with those institutions at the time. And there's a real pleasure in sitting down. In the same way, you wouldn't do your show if you didn't think that intrinsically people are interesting. And if you sit them down and give them time to talk, they will produce interesting material. And I found that period in Arkansas history, the book is set in 1997. And we forget sometimes that one of the transformative moments in the South wasn't actually civil rights. It was the invention of air conditioning. Because until air conditioning became prevalent in the South, you couldn't have high-tech industry. You can't have high-tech components in a closed factory. So an awful lot of industry was outdoors and wasn't very high-tech. As air conditioning begins to become more common, and it's really in the 70s when that happens, these high-tech and defence companies look at the South and think, well, there are very few unions down there. There are very few environmental controls
down
there. Cheap labour. Cheap labour, good tax breaks. And so you have high-tech firms, military firms, defence contractors, aeronautical people moving down to the South, setting up factories and essentially buying towns, because these places are so poor that if someone says, listen, we're going to build our town here, but you essentially have to hand over the running of the town to the company, everybody's boat will rise. You'll have better schools and better roads. And in a way, you could make an argument for saying that one of the contributors to perhaps the increasing, the ongoing conservatism of that region can be traced back to air conditioning, can be traced back to these big companies coming down and essentially moving industries that would be regarded as being quite intrinsically conservative, if you're talking about defence contractors, if you're talking about the aerospace industry. Missile Command moved down to the south. So that has to colour the texture of a society, one would have thought. So I just found that period quite interesting.
Fascinating stuff. I have to move you on, though, to the Culture Club's choices. And I am going to jump forward to books, given that you are an author. I mean, how much reading do you do, and what sort of reading do you do before I ask you to nominate a favourite book or favourite author?
I set myself the task of reading 100 books a year. My other half thinks there's a degree of obsessiveness to it. But I felt that I was sometimes wasting time that I could be spent reading. I was watching TV or I was foostering about. I read very little mystery fiction. Mainly because it's a bit like a magician watching magic tricks. You're kind of looking to see how the trick is done. But I've also reached an age where I'm very conscious of the gaps in my knowledge. And I realise there is music that I should have listened to. There are books I should have read. So I find myself increasingly going backwards, reading a lot of non-fiction and trying to fill in those gaps in my knowledge of which I've become increasingly aware.
What sort of things? When it comes to non-fiction,
I love Dominic Sambrook, although Dominic Sambrook, politically, I wouldn't have a great deal in common with him. But I find his history of Great Britain, which began, I think, at the end of the 1950s and has now moved up to the 80s, which is a period, obviously, of which I would have quite clear memories. I just find those quite fascinating. They're my treat. So I think his most recent book, Who Dares Wins, I've been saving it. It's 800 pages, about 3 years of the 1980s. And I can't think of something more pleasurable to spend my time with than that. And then I'm a bit of a male geek. So I have books on music, books on film. I find those fascinating. But history, increasingly history of the time that I was alive. And perhaps I wasn't quite as aware of it when I was growing up.
We have a fascinating choice, though. You went for P.G. Woodhouse for Jeeves and Wooster as your favourite books and author. Why so?
Yeah, I can't like somebody who doesn't like P.G. Woodhouse. I just wouldn't trust them. He wrote 21 novels about these two characters, and there are people who prefer the Blandings novels, but I think there's a kind of sourness to the Blandings novels and a kind of absence at their centre. Lord Emsworth, who is just concerned about his pig, doesn't engage me as much in Jeeves and Wooster, but Jeeves and Wooster are the perfect double act. But there are also these, every story, every novel, every page of Wooster will have one line that will make you smile. And one line that will marvel at the construction of it. My favourite insult is one that Bertie Wooster uses at one point when somebody has let him down slightly. And what he says to him is tinkerty tonk, old bean, and I meant it to sting. And I just thought that's Woodhouse in a nutshell, that even when somebody is being insulting, they can't quite bring themselves to say anything that would be genuinely hurtful. And I found it during lockdown. I found that escaping into this beautiful world, this world where your only real care was the idea that somebody might have stolen your uncle's silver cow creamer, to be just such a relief from everything that was going on around me.
Let's hear a little bit of Henry Cecil reading from The Code of the Woosters by P.G. Woodhouse.
I suppose that when two men of iron will live in close association with one another, there are bound to be occasional clashes, and one of these had recently popped up in the Wooster home. Jeeves was trying to get me to go on a round-the-world cruise, and I would have none of it. But in spite of my firm statements to this effect, scarcely a day passed without him bringing me a sheaf or nosegay of those illustrated folders which the Ho for the Open Spaces birds send out in the hope of drumming up custom. His whole attitude recalled irresistibly to the mind that of some assiduous hound who will persist in laying a dead rat on the drawing-room carpet, though repeatedly apprised by word and gesture that the market for same is sluggish or even non-existent. Jeeves, I said, this nuisance must now cease.
Travel is highly educational, sir.
I can't do with any more education. I was full up years ago. No, Jeeves, I know what's the matter with you. The old Viking strain of yours has come out again. You yearn for the tang of the salt breezes. You see yourself walking the deck in a yachting cap. Possibly someone's been telling you about the dancing girls of Bali. I understand and I sympathize, but not for me. I refuse to be decanted into any blasted ocean-going liner and lugged off round the world.
Very good, sir.
Wow, John Connolly, I'd imagine many of your fans couldn't believe that the man behind the Charlie Parker novels would pick that as your favourite.
I know, and Woodhouse wrote a lovely semi-memoir, which I think is called Over 70, which has one of my favourite lines in it, in which he says, Shakespeare's stuff is different from mine, which is not to say that it's inferior, which I think may be one of the greatest jokes I've ever seen written down on a page. I just think it's a marvellously constructed little joke. So yeah, I love Woodhouse.
We asked you also for favourite musicals and plays. You say you're not much for musicals, although you love Singing in the Rain. But I'm fascinated by the last play you say you saw on Broadway, because it was actually the last one I saw on Broadway as well, Al Pacino and Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah, I go up and down with Mamet. Mamet turned out to be quite disappointing in his political beliefs, as he was one of those guys who got more right-wing as he got older, I think. But I because I loved the film of Glengarry Glen Ross, in which Jack Lemmon plays the kind of weak link in the company. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's essentially about they're real estate traders. They're trading. They're trying to get people to invest in these awful, valueless plots of property. And in the film, it was Jack Lemmon who played the weak link in the company. And by the time I saw it on Broadway, Al Pacino, who had played the Ricky Roma, the star salesman, was actually old enough to play the Lemmon role. And there was something fascinating about it, this actor that I had associated so much with kind of strength and energy, playing this character who was really at the end of his tether, who had seen his best days and sees one chance. To grasp the person that he once was. He grasps it and he fails. And I just loved it. And it's also, maybe it's my attention span, but it's quite short. You know,
David Harbour was in it as well. If I'm around. Richard Schiff, who's a good friend, Toby from the West Wing, who's a great friend of this programme as well. He was also in it. He'll be with us again on the programme shortly. So that's a really interesting choice you have. And movies, you said there are so many movies and it could change tomorrow, but you went for John Carpenter's The Thing.
I love The Thing. And I suspect it may be one of the films I've seen more than anything. You know, it's made in 1982. It's a complete failure when it comes out because it's overshadowed by E.T., two films about aliens. One is a very cuddly alien who comes down and has a little heart like that shines and, you know, befriends a kid. And the other is a creature that essentially assumes the form of the people around it. It infiltrates. You don't know. It's almost like a metaphor for paranoia. But what I particularly love about it is the last great gasp of in-camera movie effects. The special effects were done by a guy called Rob Bottin, and they're all plastic and wire and clay. There is nothing, there's no CGI. So everything you see, somebody had to create with their hands. And it gives an immediacy to what you see, because I think we're very conscious as viewers of the uncanny valley. We look at things, it's like those dreadful Star Wars prequels where everything is generated by a computer and nothing feels real and nothing feels true. And I sometimes think I would much rather have a slightly flawed creature that's been created by hand and made out of wire and plaster than I would a perfectly realised computer rendition of the same.
I'm told we have the trailer for The Thing, which gives a good sense of what it's all about.
12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
You guys gotta listen to Gary. He can beat one of those things.
The Thing. I'm going to turn to music now, and we ask everybody who is part of the Culture Club to nominate the first piece of music they'll ever admit to having purchased. What was yours?
I can hold my head up. The first one I paid for with my own money was Kate Bush's Wuthering Heights,
which still remains brilliant music.
Yeah, an extraordinary
piece. 40 years on.
Yeah, and 1978. Yeah, because I remember I was waiting on Top of the Pops to watch ABBA. I was an ABBA obsessive, and I still, my kids despair slightly of me, but I recently went out and bought all their albums on vinyl when they were reissued. You know, I just think ABBA are fantastic, and as they grew older, their music became more adult, and I think maybe my kids didn't quite see that. They just heard what they thought were chirpy tunes. But I remember I was waiting to watch ABBA and instead this extraordinary young woman came on. I don't think I'd ever, that lovely phrase where the lady makes my tummy feel funny. There was probably a slight dawning of pre-adolescent sexuality as well, as I looked at her and thought, my God, this woman is just incredible. But a piece of music quite unlike anything I had ever heard before.
Let's hear a bit of Wuthering Heights.
Like my jealousy, too hard to greedy.
still a wonderful piece of music. I wonder, was it always her best?
Oh, I don't know. I can listen to Man with the Child in His Eyes or pieces of Hounds of Love and find something marvellous in them. She is still on my mulligan list, I think. You know, that list of people you're allowed to run away with if they say that, you know, Jenny has Brad Pitt, and I think I have her. I've Kate Bush and Jessica Chastain, should they ever suddenly find that they're incurably lonely, and Jenny can just shrug her shoulders and go, well, they were on the list, they're fine.
John, we're obviously of a very close age because you have nominated as your favourite album, one that would be very much in my list as well, best, The Blue Nile, A Walk Across the Rooftops.
Yeah, The Blue Nile are a kind of extraordinary proposition. They've recorded four albums, I think, since 1983, and Walk Across the Rooftops is the first of them. And I have very particular associations with it. I remember I bought it during the when I went to America for the first time. I can remember buying it in a little store in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, because I had bought Hats, their second album, and then I was going back to rediscover them. So, and in a way, A Walk Across the Rooftops is a book about graduating from college. It's also a book that's in love, I think, with the possibility of America. I think it's written by young men who've never seen America. And yet again and again...
They're a Scottish band.
Yeah, they're from Glasgow. And again, the music comes back to images of America. But during that summer, my father got very, very ill. And I came back. It turned out he had cancer. And like a lot of men of his age, he had never gone to a doctor. You know, he was just worried, I think. And I think he knew. I think he was so sick that he knew there was something wrong. And I think he was afraid to be told what it was, and eventually he just collapsed. And I found a real consolation in that album. You know, it's not the most cheerful music. I think I remember the critic Giles Smith once described the opening of it as like a dying man tapping on a storage heater in a vain effort to attract attention, which is very, very close to what it sounds like. But there's such beauty in it, and I keep rediscovering it every so often. I'll go back to it and I will listen to it and I will find something that I hadn't noticed before or something that I had forgotten. And it is my Desert Island album. If I had to take one album away, I think I would always find some consolation in that record. I think it's just quite beautiful.
Was your father all right at the time?
Oh, God, oh no. He I came back in September and I think he died at the start of October. But that album should cast a cloud over me in a way, because you think if you associate it with that very difficult period of time. But in a sense, no. Every time I hear it, I just remember consolation.
Let's hear the very beautiful song Stay. Home after the programme this evening. That's the album I'll be listening to, A Walk Across the Rooftops from the Blue Nile.
I was just saying, it meant quite a lot to me, and turned out that a friend of mine, the writer Paul Charles, his day job is managing bands. He looks after Jackson Browne and Elvis Costello, but he also looked after the Blue Nile. And they were performing in Vicar Street, and he said, would you like to go and see them and maybe meet Paul afterwards? And so I came along and I had my copy of A Walk Across the Rooftops with me. And I saw Paul Buchanan and he was introduced to me. We'd met very briefly once before, but I'd gone back to that album for some reason. And I hugged him. And I hugged him for slightly too long, you know, where you just want to, and I just was so overcome by emotion, and I could feel him trying to disentangle himself from me. No, don't let me go, Paul Buchanan, I love you.
Okay, you've also gone to that era, and I think there's a trend here, because when we asked you for band, you went for Prefab Sprout.
Yeah, I wanted to be, there was a little part of me that could understand musicians like Paddy McAloon of Prefab Sprout or Edwin Collins of Orange Juice. These slightly over-serious young men who had probably read too many books and listened to too much music and would probably carry vinyl records around under their arms in a vague effort to impress girls. And I could understand where they were coming from. And I think Steve McQueen, Prefabs for its second album, is a perfect suite of songs. It's a quite extraordinarily lovely album. And again, I was signing my last book, last year's book, in Waterstones in Newcastle. And so I was signing in the queue, and the guy who was looking after you, Waterston, said, "Oh, look, one of our local celebrities is in." I said, "Who's that?" I said, "Paddy McAloon of Prefab Street." And I left the queue, dashed up to Paddy McAloon, and pretty much did a Paul Buchanan on him again and said, "You don't know how much your music has meant to me over the years." And I got a picture of him. I don't know if you've seen him lately, Paddy McAloon. He looks like an Old Testament preacher now. His hair is quite long and grey, and he's got a long grey beard. And he's taken to occasionally to wearing white suits, so he looks like an Old Testament preacher who might also have owned slaves at one point. It was lovely to be able to say thank you to him. We very rarely get to say thank you to people who've meant something to us in that way.
From the album Steve McQueen, this is the wonderful tune When Love Breaks Down.
Absence makes the heart lose weight, yeah. Till love breaks down, love breaks down.
Another album I'm going to have to go back and listen to again, haven't listened to in ages, Prefab Sprouts, Steve McQueen, that track When Love Breaks Down. We asked you for the best gig you were at, and before we get to the one you chose, you did mention David Byrne at the Three Arena last year, and you're not the first person who said that to me. Anyone who was at it was just blown away by how brilliant he remains.
Yeah, not just that, by how innovative the staging was by being so minimal, because for those who weren't there, essentially the stage was just three sides of chains, and the band, there was nothing else on the stage. I think he opens up his first song sitting at a table looking at a skull, because he's David Byrne, so that's what you do. But then when they got rid of the table and skull, there's actually nothing else apart from the band, and the band are all barefoot and wearing suits, and they simply play and perform. And so you're fixed constantly on the movements of the people on the stage, and you engage with the music in a slightly different way. The next evening, I went to see the Electric Light Orchestra. And that was a very traditional gig. That was screens and lasers and loud, and it was loud, and it was very showy. And it left me entirely cold. And I think I would have enjoyed it far more had I not been at the David Byrne gig the night before and had seen a very different way of presenting a concert and presenting music.
You obviously go to a lot of gigs, so you're missing them badly with lockdown?
I am. I am and I'm not. I grew increasingly irate. I would be tense before I went into a gig, because I knew that there would be somebody talking on their phone or somebody who wanted to view the entire concert through a screen and was holding it up in front of me. And also, tickets became so expensive that a lot of real music fans were being priced out of the market. And so you had people going to gigs who were going there, not because they necessarily loved the music, but because a particular concert was the one to be seen at.
You went for your favourite gig of all time, Prince at the O2 in London.
I felt the way, when Prince died, I felt the way a lot of people felt when Bowie died. I thought something of the colour and innovativeness of the world had died with him. And what I loved about that gig in London was not just that he was fantastic and he had so much energy and so much joy, and there was so much music at his fingertips that he had to reduce a lot of songs to a medley, was that we hung around afterwards because there had been rumours that he would play one extra song, and the lights had all gone up. And there were still a handful of people holding on vaguely in the hope that he might come out. And the roadies came on with those big cases that they do to pack stuff away. And so the roadies were packing stuff away, and one of the cases came to kind of the front of the platform, and they opened it, and inside it was Prince sitting at a keyboard. Now, you know, he's in a box, essentially, and he plays one more tune and then they wheel the box away. And I thought, that was just such a perfect way to end an evening. You know, I loved him for that alone.
I don't think we have that particular moment, but we do have him for one of the 21 concerts in a row that he played at the O2 in London in 2007. I was lucky enough to see him live three times as well. He was just magnificent.
There's a fantastic moment. There was a concert for George Harrison, a memorial concert a few years back, organised by his son Danny. And you can find a little extract on YouTube, I think, where they're playing, I think, "While My Guitar Gently Weeps," and it cuts to Prince, who performs this incendiary solo, and everybody on stage just gapes at it. And then at the end of it, Prince throws his guitar up in the air and walks off the stage, and the guitar doesn't come back down. It's still one of them, a fantastic piece of stagecraft. It's probably still up there somewhere.
Television, I understand you grew up with Doctor Who and still have a fondness from it, but tell us, what would your recent choices have been?
I would probably pick Better Call Saul. I'm one of those naysayers about Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad did not do it for me.
Really? Because I've actually only watched it in the last few months and I have one episode left, the final episode to watch, and Ellie and myself
have become enthralled
by it. So it'd
be terrible if I told you what happens now.
Well, I think I've worked out what's likely to happen, but we'll see. I just think it was terrific. Better Call Saul, though, I've watched the first series of it, having gotten things wrong way around, much, much slower.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem with Breaking Bad for me. I think the first two seasons, I think, are really, really interesting. This gradual corruption of this man.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it. Walter White is a school teacher. He thinks he's dying. And so he begins, making meth so that he can sell it, so that he can fund his family, essentially, after he's gone. And then he kind of transforms a little bit too rapidly for my liking into this figure, Heisenberg, this kind of mastermind figure. And at that point, it lost me. It became a bit unreal.
To finish out, we need to take a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Let's actually hear it and then we'll talk to you about it.
What?
I don't appreciate that beep, sir.
Oh, well, you know, the light had turned green and I gave you time. You must have drifted off or something.
No, I didn't drift.
Were you daydreaming?
No, I was doing important police business.
Well, with all due respect, a green light is not the time to be doing police business.
Sir, I don't appreciate the aggressiveness of the beep.
Oh, yeah, well, you know what? This is my friend's car and I'm not really attuned to the subtleties of the horn yet. It was merely just a reminder to people, a subtle way of telling you, time to go, let's get moving on.
License and registration, please. I'm going to write you a ticket.
A ticket?
It was a bad decision on your part to honk at a police officer.
Oh, what? Why? Are you above the beep?
Absolutely. I'm a police officer. I protect your rights.
My rights to beep. That's one of my rights.
Yeah, but you don't...
Beeping. That's a right. That's America. We're allowed to beep.
Yeah, well, I'm allowed to write this ticket.
Good. Write it.
You getting smart with me, boy?
I'm not getting smart. I am smart, by the way. I'm smart.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'll be protesting this ticket. I hope you enjoy your day in court.
Here you go. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You made my day. No one's above the beep. No one.
Larry David in full flow. What do you love so much about that, John Connolly?
Well, there are two things. Increasingly, as I get older, he's horrible, but yet he just doesn't care. And there's a little part of me that really wants to be that person that doesn't have to be nice all the time. But also what he taps into very accurately is the aggressiveness that underlies American politeness.
Unfortunately, we haven't got time to get to podcasts. We've been chatting so long. I'm way over time, but I've really, really enjoyed this. John Connolly's new novel is The Dirty South, the 18th Charlie Parker mystery. Thank you, John, for joining us on the Culture Club here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.